I'm Robert Scott, the eldest son of William Scott, the artist who's showing here at Hepworth Wakefield. Where we are here, in the archive showcase, is a photograph of an exhibition in New York in 1954, where you've got Francis Bacon, Barbara Hepworth, and William Scott showing. And this painting over there is in the photo, and we managed to find it. And I had the idea that it'd be nice to recreate that exhibition in a modern context. And it started from there. Later, the Tate Gallery wanted to become involved because it's the centenary of my father's birth, and they have set up an exhibition in St. Ives, which is left to come here, where it's expanded and been altered, again with the curator putting her input into how we should be viewing it.
So with the exhibition, then you've got these three exhibitions. I mean, can you tell me how they have evolved then, and how you kind of see it going forward?
Well, the overriding factor was that the Tate would just borrow from national galleries, national collections, and a few from our own collection, and so they had that limitation. It's not really a retrospective, because here there are only two figure paintings in the exhibition, whereas for a whole period of time he was doing a lot of figures, and there's a cut-off period where the later work isn't shown in the proportion. So it's got a particular perspective, and I think it works very well.
So how does this exhibition then specifically relate to Yorkshire?
I think the connection would be with Helen Capp, who's the director of the old Wakefield Art Gallery. She was organising an exhibition called Vision and Reality. This is over 50 years ago. And she writes a list of who she was going to put in it. And interestingly, William Scott was the second on her list, and others she'd sort of crossed out. But we saw this document at the opening of the Hepworth Gallery, and I thought it significant, a very significant document. So we built a lot around those connections. So the exhibition took place, and there were some 16 works by William Scott in Vision and Reality. And one of them is here in the permanent collection.
We've got this archival display here. I mean, could you elaborate more on how the archive has inspired this exhibition?
Well, we have an archive that's going right back, which the William Scott Foundation has in London. It has an amazing series of letters from artists and art galleries. It also lists all the material and the paintings that existed. So some 20 years ago this is, we started a catalogue resume of just the works on oil, which was published last week. And one of the first copies is here in the museum, where you can see it. The work that you see here is a very small part of his oeuvre. And the interesting thing is that there's material that came from our archive, which is now all condensed into the catalogue resume. So there's some over 900 works which are described, a lot of them in detail, where they've been. And that was research which the last 7 years has been very concentrated. And we managed to get it out in the year of his centenary.
What other artists then was he associated with during his life?
There was the Americans, we think of, as you had his gallery represented Jackson Pollock in New York. There was de Kooning, there was Mark Rothko. It's probably the best known, because Mark Rothko would come and stay with us. But there were also British artists. You had, from this area, you had Terry Frost, with all his children. He would come down and he would stay with us on his way down to the West Country. Then there was Patrick Heron, Francis Bacon, of course. Number. And when I was a boy, I didn't realize that these people were famous. I just thought they were Dad's mates. And it was only later that I realized that they were artists who were up and coming or already famous. I remember my father had this very small Fiat Cinquecento, and he shows it to Patrick Heron. They both are in the car. And my father went to start the car up, and it wouldn't go. And Patrick said, "William, you're pressing the cigarette lighter." There were other instances where he could never really remember where he'd parked the car from the night before, and we would struggle looking for them. But probably the most important thing that happened to my father was he developed Alzheimer's, and so the last 8 or 9 years of his life, he couldn't sensibly communicate, and it deteriorated, of course. And we give all our royalties to stem cell research. And this is something I've been doing for the last 20 years.
So he had Alzheimer's, and now you're kind of using his legacy almost to help future generations, I suppose.
Yes, you're right. We are. We hope it will. Significant developments are taking place, and we're hoping.
Yeah, I mean, did he work while having Alzheimer's, or did he kind of give up after that? Or
he had, his mind was still very visual, but he had great difficulty in being able to organise paints or organise a canvas, and that physical side that then became impossible. So there was a while when he was painting, and then it faded.
How was that for him to kind of, you know, did he find that quite upsetting that he couldn't paint anymore? Or
yes, he was very, very frustrated, because there was all of this. We knew it was in him. It was all locked up, and he wanted it to come out, and he couldn't. He was also very aware but upset when he was left out of the 1984 Royal Academy exhibition, Survey of British Art, and they left him out.
So, I mean, this is an interesting theme I've noticed with quite a few British modernists. It seems to be you get this kind of hierarchy in history, and certain ones seem to get forgotten, regardless of how big they were during a lifetime. And I think you can see it with someone like Jacob Epstein, who there was a real effort in the 1980s to kind of rebuild his reputation. And I was just wondering if that's the kind of same thing now that's going to be happening with William Scott, in that, you know, you're kind of wanting to kind of reevaluate his position in the history of art, and kind of, you know, actually assess his importance and kind of bring it back to the fore. Is that something that you're trying to do? Or
well, it will probably happen. My intervention wouldn't really change things. But what was his problem was He was just beginning when war broke out. Whereas you had people like Henry Moore and Ben Nicholson, who were that much older and had their reputations in motion. So he had to then start all over again. He'd worked in France and he'd been noticed. We have press cuttings there in the 38 and 39. And he did a fair amount of work during the war, even had exhibitions. He was to go to the Far East because during the war he was a cartographer, which was making maps from photos. So they would identify landmarks. And this is a thing that artists are very good at doing. They can abstract the essential information from a photo. And at that time, they were being used every night. They would print them. So lithography came into it, which is why he did a range of lithographs. And so the bombers would go out at night with the new plans that they had done to go and bomb Dresden or wherever. But when the Far East war was raging, the distance was too far for the reconnaissance planes to make it back. So they decided to take that section of the Royal Engineers over to wherever they were going. And Halifax was where the centre, the RAF centre, was. And they waited for the ship. They were going to be taken to a ship. And they waited in Halifax for the message. And the ship had come and gone without that unit. And I have recollections as a young boy of waiting in Halifax. We were rather near there yesterday.
So, I mean, what regiment was it that he served with then? Was that?
It was the Royal Engineers.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, with the kind of cartography, with, you know, this idea of cray maps and abstraction, do you think that those kind of skills filtered into his work beyond that?
Oh, very much so, yes. That this thing of abstracting, when you look at these paintings here, they are abstracted. That one in the corner is a harbour.
Okay, so they're not just kind of, I mean, a lot of abstract artists kind of work on pure form, but these are actually abstractions from kind of real objects.
From real, yeah. And real places.
And that's a harbour as well. Clearly defined,
yes.
But so abstract still.
So I mean, one thing then that I've noticed looking at Scott's work is there's, you know, certain motifs that appear again and again. And I was just wondering, you know, what could you tell me a little bit about the pears, for example? The image of the pear seems to come up again. Do you know what that meant to him, or why he kind of used that motif at all?
Well, we've found a pear painting dating back to 1935. That was the first pear. Then it doesn't appear until probably in the early 1970s when he does an amazing series of called The Orchard of Pears. I mean, there were occasional ones, of course, in between then, but it became very significant. And he had a pear tree. It was an espalier, which he personally would attend to.
When he kind of unwound, did he used to do a lot of gardening then and things like that, or was it just something that was there on his property? Or?
The gardening, he had a market garden after the war, when produce was rather rare or expensive. He grew all his own plants, and he personally looked after that side. So he was interested in nature, and we also had chicken. But there's no painting in this exhibition, but there are some in existence where he would go and get a chicken, and he would wring its neck and then cut its legs off and run after us, pulling the tendons, so that we were absolutely terrified. Later we can laugh about that.
So he was a kind of a bit of a joker then, you know, a bit of a.
He had a very dry sense of humour. I wouldn't have said he was a joker, not in the sense of, say, Terry Frost, who was a bundle of laughs all the time, but he was a very serious man. As boys, we didn't really see a lot of him. He was working in the studio.
So where was the studio then? Was that part of your home, or was it elsewhere?
It was in the West Country. Well, I had left home by then, but he stayed in the West Country, where my mother had come from. My father was from, born in Scotland, but lived in Enniskillen, and then went to Belfast. So a lot of the Somerset background, when you look at these paintings here with the cottages there, they were either Brittany or Somerset or Ireland, the same image, although he didn't paint them in Ireland, but you can see these little white houses with the grey roofs, which then become abstract and they become the shapes that you can see all around us. I was thinking probably his great struggle as an artist was when pop art emerged on the scene, and that later was taken over by installations, whereas he was still very much connected with the quality of paint and paintbrushes. He'd done a large mural, which is going to be shown again in Derry, the City of Culture, this year, which was done for the Altna Gelvin Hospital in 1958. But it looks today so modern, so fresh, it's timeless.
Could you tell me then a little bit about these archival displays we've got here? Because, I mean, it is quite unusual, isn't it, to bring in sort of archive material within an exhibition and not just informing it.
This photo here is a photo taken in New York at the Martha Jackson Gallery, where you have Barbara Hepworth and William Scott and Francis Bacon. My father introduced Barbara Hepworth to his gallery in New York, and this letter here is from Barbara Hepworth, where she says, "Dear William, thank you for your letter and for sending the list and news of Martha. I'm very glad I'm fixed up with her." And this letter is my father writing to Barbara Hepworth and telling her about the Martha Jackson Gallery. And Martha Jackson had represented people like de Kooning. The other photo is my father with de Kooning, which is not here.
So how was William Scott received in America? Did he have much of a kind of critical reception, or were they quite dismissive because he was a Brit?
Yes, he did. He was well received, and there are paintings by him in the Guggenheim and the Museum of Modern Art of that time. He reacted to the American work that was going on, Jackson Pollock's and things. He went back after this abstraction, which is very abstract. The thing he did was to paint larger, but he went to not in this room, but next door there, you will see he went back to a more figurative So that was his reaction to the Americanism.
So did he see maybe the work of people like Pollock as being quite excessive? Was that a bit too much? Did he kind of retreat from that? Or?
Oh, no. No, he accepted. He accepted that work, but it focused him back onto, away from his abstraction, because he felt he had gone too far the other way. This painting over here, which is the original one, is very painterly when one looks at all the textures and the different types of black and grey, which normally you just pass by and think nothing of it. But when you study it, you realise there's an enormous amount of detail there.
So was he concerned then with, you know, ideas of... Were his paintings kind of about painting, if that makes sense? Were they about kind of what can be done with surface, what can be done with relationships of colour?
Well, I think subject wasn't actually very important to him. It was for the viewer to make what they wanted out of it. But paintings like this are very simple. It's whether that's a still life or is it a figure? We don't know.
See, to me that looks like a floor plan. Like, you know, when architectural plans
indeed.
And things.
This painting here was done in 1972 at the time of his retrospective at the Tate Gallery. It's probably one of his largest paintings. But there's a lot there, and the subtleties and shapes and the relationship with the objects and the edge of the canvas, which was something that was always very important to him.
So what's this one called?
This will be Egyptian series. This is actually number 5. And the others are slightly different. They're not really Egyptian, but it was a title he gave them.
They're very sparse, aren't they, in terms of what's actually there?
Yes, it's very much the relationship of the objects. When people do fakes or try to do books, they don't quite get the perfection that he had, as we can tell immediately that, well, it's a fake. Now we've done the catalogue résiné, it's definitive. So. Interestingly, there is a painting called Liverpool Still Life. He won a prize with the John Moores, and the people of Liverpool said, well, we don't want to buy this for £70. We don't like this rubbish, they said. And it's now in the National Museum of Modern Art in Paris. And they bought it. And of course it hit the headlines because Liverpool had said no. And France had said yes.
Very short-sighted of them.
Very short-sighted, fickle. But it is still called the Liverpool Still Life. This painting is in the Tate Gallery. It's got a lot of texture in it, and even sand. It is called white sand and ochre, in fact, and it has texture there.
I mean, it looks very rough, the surface, doesn't it?
Yes, and it's very, very matte, which is normally what his paintings, they were always matte. The one from Liverpool has probably been varnished since he painted it.
So have you got any particular favourites?
Oh, what a question.
Because obviously you'll have probably seen more works than anyone else, really.
Yes, I probably have. In fact, I think one of my favourites, it has no colour in, you would think, is this grey and black one. But when you go over to it, it's full of colour. It's not immediately apparent. So over here, There are greens and blues and browns and drawing coming through. And this is, I think, is a lovely painting.
It reminds me of looking through like frosted glass onto, I don't know, some kind of...
Yes, it could be almost a cool lager or something, just sort of condensing. You can see it and you can't see it.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
This painting was always hanging behind the, in the director of the Tate Gallery's desk. Sir Alan Bowness had that the time he was director. This is interesting because it's actually probably one of the last paintings before he went totally abstract. It's 52, so in 53 and 54 he was doing the abstract ones we were looking at in the other room.
I mean, in a sense, this still really echoes that kind of, you know, abstract composition, because you have got, you know, almost like a monochrome background, a circle, and then, you know, well, an ellipse, and then a simple fish.
And you have that lovely texture that you can... It's very painterly.
Yeah.
This texture there, and then this flatness.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the composition of that is fantastic, actually. Really.
Yes.
I love the fact that, you know, half the painting is pretty much flat and plain, and it's just, you know, you've given it, it's almost like it's given space to breathe.
And it just focuses on the fish and, and the plate. You asked me before about the pears.
Yeah.
And this is a very nice combination, because you have a period of time. We're talking about 1956 here, and then his Orchard of Pears, which is 20 years later, 1976. So that's what's happened in 20 years. Total abstraction.
Yeah, they've just turned into flat representations.
Yes. Yeah.